the world's fastest growing online personal trainer, a best-selling author, and an advocate for being confident. Welcome to the Maz Hakim podcast, James Smith.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's such a pleasure to have you. James, I'm going to ask you a million dollar question that I'm sure everyone always asks. What is the key to weight loss?
Sure, I've been asked this question a lot of times. Calorie deficit. I mean, this is the single piece of advice that I was never given. This is kind of how I got a voice on social media, where for years I was misled, I was doing things wrong, and you grow a sense of frustration with that. Then when you eventually learn how to lose fat, you're kind of like, where the hell was that information when I needed it? Why the hell wasn't I given that? And that frustration kind of coined the way that I operate social media and calling out misinformation. Mm-hmm. And yeah, then all the accolades from there on in have come off the back of that.
And how do you know how many calories you should intake?
A very easy way for people. And again, there's so many different methods you can use for fat loss. And make this very simple. You have, you know, let's think of it this way. On the left, you have you. On the right, you have calorie deficit. But that's not just as simple as it is. There are loads of methods in between. And there's a lot of nuance to that. And a huge collective of those are within the calorie counting.
Okay.
So the preface or the beginning of that is, this won't work for everyone. And some people, I'm sure you've had something, oh, calorie counting doesn't work. You're like, wrong way to argue it. It does work. It's just not great for people. Mm-hmm. Calorie counting's really bad for mental health. You're like, okay, it's probably bad for some people's mental health, but it doesn't mean you eradicate it for everyone. There's a certain amount of calories that someone's going to burn. Calorie calculators online are a means of determining that. And it's a rough estimate. It's a beginning tool to say to someone. And the way they determine that is height, weight, age, then a perception of how active you are. Okay. Very simple. Mm-hmm. Bigger people burn more calories than small people. Then active people burn more calories than sedentary people. You get given a number. And people, again, will try and argue and go, that's not accurate, da da da. And you're like, mate, shut up. There's three things that are going to happen, okay? One, nothing. What do we know? The number's too high. What do? Reduce it by 10%. Two more things will happen. It'll either work or it won't. If it doesn't work, reduce by 10% more. James, am I not going to undereat? Well, no, because we've only reduced 10% and we know the 10% above it wasn't enough for a deficit. Mm-hmm. So people have that tool there. Another thing that happens is they lose weight in the beginning. Another thing that happens is they might, by whatever reason, gain weight. But we can't determine which direction of action to go until we've trialed it. And these calorie calculators are a start point. So I'm already battling the things that people are going to try and be combative with what I just said with. So yeah, that's the way that fat loss occurs. There's many complexities to it. It's a simple answer to a complex task.
What are your thoughts on intermittent fasting?
It is skipping a meal.
Okay.
Like, there are some people that are going to come here and say it's the best thing ever. If you're looking to lose weight, it's pretty good. You know, reducing 1 in 3 meals, even, you know, people having normal feedings. For the majority of people, when you push them back to 1 p.m. and they stop eating, they will eat less, categorically. Mm-hmm. We also need to take into account the digestive system is a big system. It requires a lot of energy. So suddenly you reduce people's calories. Mm-hmm. They feel great in the first half of the day. They're like, oh my God, ever since I started intermittent fasting, I feel like I've got so much more energy. I'm like, one of your biggest systems just got a break. Yeah. So we have that. Then we have the reduction in calories. However, again, it's nuanced. If I've got Pete coming in, he's desperate to grow muscle. He goes, I've heard about this intermittent fasting. I'm like, mate, if you're struggling to build muscle, chances are you're not eating enough, you're not training hard enough. By skipping breakfast, he's making himself further from his goal. So it's not a one-size-fits-all thing. Mm-hmm. I know you've had some people on the podcast that talk about, you know, like autophagy and anti-aging and all of these. There are so many factors within our control we can use to improve our quality of life. It is irresponsible and irrational to just say that skipping a meal does enough. So again, some people love breakfast, some people can go easily without it. A reduction in calories is one of the main things we need. Cool, yep. We do that. But we cannot purport intermittent fasting to be the be all and end all for health and everything else, because we have not looked at other markers like sleep, like sunlight exposure, like alcohol, like stressors, like notifications on their phone, all of these things. Mm-hmm. And what I hate is, if we give intermittent fasting too much ownership as a health-seeking behavior, we all too easily overlook the other components of health. So it's one of those things I'm passionate about. Mm-hmm. People go, intermittent fasting, is it good? I'm like, for who? So that's
right.
My answer.
So you mentioned being active. What is the ideal, how many times a week should you work out?
As many as you can.
Okay.
And that's going to change through your life. Mm-hmm. When you have kids, it's going to reduce. Mm-hmm. When you have a tough time at work, it's going to reduce. When it's summer in, you know, Dubai and the marina's too hot, it's going to reduce. Mm-hmm. If you can finish each day and go, I did as much as I could, who can challenge that? And if it's once a week, cool, whatever. But rather than saying, you know, how many times should we train? We should change and rephrase that question, even to ourselves.
Yeah.
How much can I train? Because if you can't train any more than that, mm-hmm. then that's a pretty good amount, irrespective of it. And too much focus gets put on training. So training is fantastic.
Yeah.
Any time you can spend in the gym, and anyone listening to this, is to get stronger.
Okay.
That's my best bit of advice. And people go, oh, but you know, I want to lose weight. Cardio burns more calories. I'm like, yeah, cool, I get that, but use this opportunity to get stronger. Some mm-hmm. people are, oh, I'm too old to get into weight training. After 30, our muscle, you know, muscle mass, our bone density, a lot of things start declining, irrespective of how healthy we are. Mm-hmm. We should be fighting with every inch we can to keep that, offsetting injuries, osteoporosis, sarcopenia, all of these things. Then outside of that, if we look at the components of how many calories we burn in a day, let's imagine a 10-story building. That 10-story building is the amount of calories you burn in a day. Mm-hmm. The bottom 7 floors is at rest. So that's why when you're ill and you're in bed and you lose your appetite, you drop weight. This right. is why people in comas in some situations lose fat. Mm-hmm. Because there's a certain amount of calories you burn at that point. Floor 8 is a bit of a complex one. It's called thermic effective feeding. Again, I spoke about the digestive system using a lot of calories. Then the other 3 floors we're going to look at. So 2 of these floors are called NEAT, and 1 of these floors is called EAT. Mm-hmm. NEAT is non-planned training, and EAT is planned training. Okay. So your trip to the gym will only constitute about 10% of the amount of calories you burn in a day. So if we look at just that one floor as energy expenditure, we realize its part to play in the whole scheme isn't as grand as many people portray it.
Only 10%?
Gets worse. If you train 3 times a week or 3-4 times a week, that's almost once every other day, so that 10 goes to 5. So we've got people arguing, sitting here, oh, it hits better, I know you want to be kickboxing, oh, you want to go for a run. Only a small component of the calories you burn in a day is lost there. So am I saying don't train? I'm saying don't use that as your means of burning calories. Mm-hmm. And there are way better ways. One, reduction of food intake. Again, intermittent fasting could be a great tool for that. But that NEAT component, which I spoke about, which sometimes, in most cases, is over double the amount of calories that you burn in the training, mm-hmm. is non-planned training. So I would rephrase your question you first asked me, how much should you be training a week? How much should you be moving a week? Mm-hmm. If you go around and look at the amount of people standing still on escalators, taking the lift when they could have taken the stairs, and I know it's a hot country, but people that step counts never even get into the, you know, thousands or 10,000 or whatever, yeah. The easiest way to increase the amount of calories someone burns is to get them to move more, to walk more, to stand at every opportunity. Because when you diet people and you reduce their calories, as we spoke about, the mm-hmm. first thing, when people talk about, oh, your body gets used to it, your body gets used to dieting, your body gets used to this, the biggest adapting factor is the reduction in NEAT. Women more so worse than men. If I cut your calories significantly, you will move a lot less. Mm-hmm. You will sit at every given opportunity. And both sexes are very prone to doing lazy behaviors because they know they're on a diet. Mm-hmm. Oh, walking on the escalator, yeah, but I cut my calories. I haven't had breakfast. You know, they do all these things. So instead of saying let's train 3-4 times a week and mm-hmm. do whatever, we should say to people, every day you take the stairs. Every day you walk up the escalator. Every day you do some laps of the mall. Mm-hmm. Someone goes, oh, I want to read a book. I'm like, get the audio book and go to the mall and do laps. And do steps, you know, burn energy that way. And that's something that people can do every day as part of their life. You bring kids into the situation, can't go to the gym, you're going to take the pram for a stroll around the mall, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Not enough onus is put on the energy expenditure lost through NEAT. Mm-hmm. And that's why, and also when we look at statistics and research of people gaining weight, sorry, long answer,
no,
gaining weight back from dieting periods, the people that have behaviors in line with increased amounts of NEAT do better. The people that maintain the step count, whether it's wearing a Garmin, a Fitbit, whatever it is, the people that look at their watch and they go, I've only done 4,000 steps today, and they go out and walk, they're the people that maintain the weight loss. That is the component that most people overlook when dieting and the place that's given the least love, because it's taken me a 4-minute solo segment there to explain the importance of NEAT, and that's not sexy. If I put that on Instagram, not many people go, oh my God, you need to see this reel. And that's one of the main things that people aren't told.
So what is the ideal amount to walk? Everyone says 10,000, some people say 15,000.
Again, I'm gonna bring it back as much as you can.
As much as you can.
Because if you do 5,000, I know you can do 15,000, I'm gonna be pissed off. If I'm your trainer, I'm like, what are you doing? I know you can do more. Mm-hmm. You know, also cognitively, we're better when we're standing and we're better on the move. It might have been Seneca who says, no good idea was ever thought of not walking. Work calls, whenever you get bad news, stand up. Sitting is like, if you think we've got in the central nervous system, fight or flight, rest and digest, sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. We have these two states. When we're moving, we are more sympathetic. We are more active, alert, engaged. Mm-hmm. When we're sitting, we're more relaxed. We're more parasympathetic. We're more passive, rest and digest. Yeah. So when it comes to getting things done in the day, I'm a big believer that we can do it on the move. Mm-hmm. And like, even if your boss is here, oh, you know, I've got you to make these calls, and you're like, hey, look, I'm going to do better with this sales call or this catch up or this check in with a client on the move. I'm going to put my headphones in. Everyone's had it where you're like cleaning the house, headphones in, I'm going to do my work calls. Mm-hmm. And they're like, whoa, I'm productive. So I think there's a lot of work we need to do as a society and as accepting these things. But yeah, that's like, if you can get in bed at the end of the day, you don't wear a Garmin, but you can say to yourself, I did the most amount of steps today possible, then you're a winner.
Let's talk cellulite. A lot of women want to know, is cellulite avoidable?
So there is, first of all, cellulite is very normal. Now, a lot of women watching this don't believe it's normal because they spend the majority of their time in their social media apps and smartphones and fitness magazines or whatever. So any cellulite is airbrushed, blemishes taken out. A lot of models that do shoots for magazines or social media, in their contract, it would be like, it's bad for the brand.
Right.
Yeah, if there's stretch marks or cellulite. So I know they're not quite the same, but for instance, I have stretch marks all across my arms on both sides. Mm-hmm. If I was to say to a woman, hey, I trained weights quite a lot, I've got stretch marks, is that an issue? How many women would say, oh yeah, sorry, that's a problem. The reason they don't have a problem with stretch marks is because it's perfectly normal.
Yeah.
It's an occurrence from being human, and it's not a sign that I've neglected myself. It's not a sign that I'm mistreating myself. It's just something that occurs. Men don't quite get as, self-conscious about that as women. Mm-hmm. But first of all, before we have this discussion, we need to say to women, this is normal. How many women watching or listening to this, if they were to ask their friends, how many of your friends don't have any cellulite? Cool.
Yeah.
None.
I don't know any, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So first of all, we need to pull our head out of the place that it's in and say, look, it's normal. Is it causing any grief? To you, yes, but to your body, no. Now, as far as hormonal conditions or anything else, again, any woman that has cellulite and is concerned about it, I'd say, are you training as much as you can?
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Are you as active as much as you can? Cool. Are you eating as well as you can? Is your lifestyle in the best place it can be? If you answer yes to all of those, what other questions do we have in this topic? Because if you are controlling every variable you can, you're done, that's it. And like, this is another issue, and this can be applied to anyone out there. There might be a dad listening and his colleagues are like, oh, you got a bit of a dad bod, mate. Cool. If he's eating his best, training his best, and living his best life and being the best father possible, who is someone externally to judge or invalidate that position?
Mm-hmm.
And women need to do the same. If they can't answer yes to all those questions, oh, my diet could be better, we'll go do that. My sleep could be better, we'll focus on that. My training could be better, we'll focus on that. Cellulite is almost part of the result. If you improve all of those things, it may get better.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, if we were to create a question and insert issue you're having here, if you can answer you're doing your best with those things, that's it. Because sometimes people go beyond and too far beyond their best. They stop drinking indefinitely, where you're like, a reduction would have been good. They go huge reduction on food intake and they don't go out for any social occasions when, moderating their calories could be.
Mm-hmm.
And then if they overstep the boundaries and the marks of those positive habits, they end up in a position where they're in a non-sustainable area of their life and they end up bouncing back.
Mm-hmm.
So the cellulite one, I'd love to be like, yeah, eat more carrots. But so many women are losing so much sleep over something that they might not be ever able to control that variable, mm-hmm. but all of the other ones then get overlooked.
Right.
So imagine there are potentially women listening to this, finger on their mouse, ready to buy some cellulite cream, when really the other factors, you know, sunlight, step count, training, diet, those things are going to do way more for you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my experience with every female client that I've had with cellulite.
And what about sugar? How bad is sugar?
See, this is an interesting one. I don't think sugar is as bad as what people make out.
Mm-hmm.
So sugar is very refined carbohydrates, and it's what our body will break down carbohydrates into, let's say, glucose. Now, glucose has a primary role in the body to be energy. Now, again, for who? If I've got an athlete, or mm-hmm. you know, your kid's at a sports day and he's about to go from one extra something to another, or someone that hasn't got much amounts of body fat, there is a use for that glucose.
Mm-hmm.
They need that. They'll be using that as energy.
Right.
Someone else, let's say, if you're obese and they're like, oh, can I eat sugar? And I'd probably say again to them, are you consuming too many calories? If so, I don't think your sugar intake should be too high. Sugar has been vilified and demonized for a long time. When you remove it from people's diets, a lot of the time you improve the quality of their diet, sure. Mm-hmm. But again, like if we look at obesity and the rates of obesity since like the 60s and 70s, in like the 90s and early 2000s, the rate of sugar intake actually started decreasing. And it's not something where we should just say, oh, we should be never having sugar, because there are things like, you know, do you want a bit of milk in your coffee? Yeah, cool. Mm-hmm. Should I be having low, you know, low fat products that have got a bit more sugar in it? Again, even if you have low fat milk,
mm-hmm.
the sugar content is slightly higher, but the fat content is reduced.
It's reduced, right?
The calories are significantly lower, although the glucose is higher. So when people do have low fat foods, they are getting a better deal calorie wise. But again, yeah, it's one of those things. If someone's trained hard and they need to replenish, you need to have, sometimes eating 10 potatoes isn't an option.
Yeah.
I do think that people, when I see someone like having a full fat Coke, I'm like, that's a bit stupid, you know? Have a Diet Coke and have some sweets or something, you know, make the most of that opportunity.
A better alternative, yeah, right.
Whereas sometimes I do think drinking calories can be a waste, but sugar again, someone can go sugar-free, think they're doing the best thing to their health possible, then they neglect the other key players in their diet.
Mm-hmm.
And health, well-being is like a table with many legs that support it. I don't think it's ever fair to just identify one leg of it and mm-hmm. go, this is bad.
Mm-hmm.
Same with, let's say, mental health as well. There are many things that balance this table of mental health.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of us get caught up with too many things, or we get isolated on one thing and we overlook the fact that we need legs in different places to support mm-hmm. that overarching concept. So sugar, I think too much of it is a problem. But if you look at your friends who are like the fitness freaks, the people in amazing shape, they have a great relationship with sugar. They mm-hmm. just don't really abuse it too much mm-hmm. like some people do.
Let's talk confidence. In your book, How to Be Confident, you focus on the importance of growth from failure. How do you think we get rid of fear and become more confident?
So there's an unspoken utility to failure. Every time something goes wrong, you improve your competence. So I come from a background doing door-to-door sales. Or let's say you've got someone in your team who's doing sales calls.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the chances of them picking up the phone and selling someone and having a successful experience first time are minimal.
Mm-hmm.
But the chances of them picking up the phone and gaining experience with every call, if you can say to that same person, look, I don't expect you to win this or get the sale call, but what I want you to do is with every opportunity, see someone not buying
mm-hmm.
as another string to your bow of getting better. If you can nurture someone's relationship with failing, you can then get someone who has, you know, a better mindset as far as what we'd call confidence. Someone who doesn't mind things going wrong, someone that is thick-skinned to losses or thick-skinned to failure, they get portrayed to be confident by other people. Let's say your friend goes to someone in a bar and says, hey, you know, I think you're beautiful, I'd love to give you my number.
Mm-hmm.
Has a bit of, they're very chivalrous, of course, and they say, feel free to give me a fake number, I won't mm-hmm. be offended. And the person says, hey, look, I'm really sorry, I've got a boyfriend, but thank you very much. That's flattering. And he comes back and sits with you.
Mm-hmm.
You'd go, oh, he's such a confident guy. Is it this elixir that he's a confident person? Or was it when he saw the woman, he was quite happy for that not to work out?
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't about who he was. There isn't a personality trait of confidence. There are 16 personality traits, not one of them is confidence.
Mm-hmm.
Other people would look at that. They're worried about the rejection, the embarrassment, all of these other things. They pick a path of inaction to avoid failure when the other person will use that and go, do you know what? That one chivalrous attempt, one, probably make her day, she'll go, oh, that was pleasant. Mm-hmm. You got to make sure you do it right. But two, he goes, even if that doesn't work out, I've just become more competent in the pursuit of talking to someone, having a sales call, saying to your boss that you don't feel you're valued in whatever line of work you're in. Mm-hmm. So confidence to me boils down to going through life and you end up taking two paths, either action or inaction. Confidence is about action more than anything else. There are a lot of personal trainers, You've got a lot of them in Dubai as well.
Yeah.
A lot of them have their face-to-face businesses, which I had for years. Many of them have got an iPhone, they've got a tripod because they film so much of themselves working out.
Yeah.
They don't take the choice of action when it comes to talking to the camera, to helping to people, to building a social media following. Some people are so caught up with the idea of failure and rejection and embarrassment that they'll never do the things they need to succeed. And it's only in retrospect that people would look at me and go, oh, you're a confident guy, you're confident on camera, but they don't see the years on end I did it with not much gratification. So the key to me for confidence is having a good relationship with failure.
So on a day-to-day basis, what can somebody do to try and become more confident?
First of all, I call this my Zygarnik theory of open and closed loops. Mm-hmm. Action and action, they are two paths. Now, I don't care how bad someone thinks their level of confidence is, they need to go through the day and take notes of times they took action, times they took an action. Because I think that not being confident for a lot of people is just bullshit. I think it's an excuse, something easy for you to accept for the fact that you don't take action throughout the day. Whether it is wanting to take responsibility at work, putting your hand up and going, I'll do that task, or whatever it is. They need to take stock of that, but they need to realize that inaction comes with a cost. And the cost is what I call an open loop. So let's say friend, girl in the bar, wants to approach, doesn't. She leaves, he's thinking about it all day. Woman at work, boss comes in, team leaders, hey, I need someone to take up this project. It's not gonna pay extra, but I need someone to help me out. Freezes, oh, what if I can't do it? What if I disappoint them? Someone else puts their hand up, gets the project. She goes home, she's thinking about that all night.
Yeah.
These are open loops. Similar to when they're done, did I lock the door? You have to go check the door to close the loop. Mm-hmm. So many people going through these paths of inaction lose the ability to actually close loops. And I believe that creates stress, insomnia. Like people are constantly, what if I spoke to the girl? What if I told my boss how I was? So very simply, instead of telling people to build their confidence, I tell them to close as many loops as they can throughout the day. If it's rejected, if your boss says, I don't think that you're in a stage in your career to get a promotion, a pay rise, whatever it is, telling the person that you fancied for a year that you work with, that you want to take them for a date, even if it's rejection, even if failure, even if embarrassment, close these loops around you. And if people can become focused on closing these loops in their lives, it's only other people that are going to go, so this person's got so much more confident recently. It's not about confidence, it's about action.
So the C word is confidence?
The C word is confidence.
James, where can we follow you online?
I know I've got a very common name, James Smith.
It's like probably the most common name.
I can thank my parents for that. My name is James Smith PT because being a personal trainer for a large part of my career. But if they type in James Smith, they should see a blonde, hopefully handsome man that they can follow. And it's Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, YouTube, anywhere.
How active are you on TikTok?
Oh, 1.6 million followers.
Oh, wow. Okay,
yeah.
Right.
So it's an interesting platform. It's a lot of young users. I think it plays a big place in social media at the moment because the game's changing. You used to get content off people you follow. Mm-hmm. Now you're being served content on things you're interested in. So the algorithm for how we absorb content, the whole follower model, has changed. Now you get content from the person, not the person, then the content.
So
anyone out there, I slept on TikTok for a long time.
Yeah.
And now I'm starting to respect it.
Yeah, 1.6 million.
Yeah.
How are your transitions?
Do you know what? They're a bit young. Okay. They're a bit young to become customers. You promote a book on TikTok. Yeah. They're like, yeah, no thanks. More of the funny videos. You do it on Instagram or Facebook. Facebook are the best for buying. Instagram are so-so. TikTok are like, yeah, nah, try again in 10 years.
Go and get his book, How to Be Confident. I'm reading it now. It's honestly amazing. James Smith, thank you so much.
Cheers. Thanks. Bye-bye.